You're listening to the Clean Comedy Podcast with your host, James Creviston.
Welcome to the Clean Comedy Podcast. It's James, and today I have one of my favorite comedians. I know you guys hear me say that all the time, but I'm not kidding you when I say this. The first time I saw this guy, I was watching Netflix, is when I first got Netflix. Take Note was on there. I watched it six times in a row, I think, something like that, because I was like, I can't believe. First of all, I thought he was a school teacher doing stand-up, by the way. When you first see that, he was like, I thought it was a school teacher doing stand-up. I had no idea what it was. But it's amazing, and he's blown me away. And this is how stalkerish I've been. One time I hired him to come do the Queen Comedy Hour at Burbank, and I did it just so I could feel like I was getting a private Dwayne Perkins show. So please welcome the very talented, the very funny, like one of my favorite comedians of all time, Dwayne Perkins.
Oh, thank you, James. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that intro. And it's like you have to accept. One thing about performing is you get to sort of like determine who you are to an extent. And then to a point, the audience determines who you are.
Right.
And you gotta meld those two things together. So I just have to accept I'm the comic's comic, you know? And, people like me, civilians like me too, but somehow I capture the minds of other comics more. And I've always thought, should I switch it up to try to like be more universal? And I'm universal enough, but
yeah,
I'm just a comics comic. And so I really appreciate that. And it's an honor, and I don't take it lightly. Yeah.
No, I appreciate it. I also know that you're also one of Asia's favorite comics. Garen Chu, I know you've kind of met him before.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He talks highly about you, and he says how amazing you do in Asia. And I also read your book, and you talk about doing comedy in Asia.
Right.
Like, that's amazing. Here's the truth. I didn't even know they did English comedy in Asia. Like, I assumed it would all be in Chinese whatever it was, you know?
Well, and that's another thing about just sort of like you go through life and you don't. This is why, like, I love sports, but sometimes sports radio and ESPN, sometimes it's a bit much because they're always trying to determine legacy on the fly. Legacy is sort of like something after the fact we can look back and go, oh, that's what that was. Right. But while you're doing it, you're just doing it. So for me to go to Asia, it's just about finding expats that love comedy. And that's my crowd in a sense, because they're people who are usually pretty accomplished to even, you know, accomplished, willing to sort of experience new things. So that's kind of my crowd. And so for me, it's just about going to where the shows are and where my credits work. Like the credits I have, sometimes they don't mean that much in Hollywood because a lot of other people have those credits, you know, but I've always followed the love. So I can call a booker in Asia who doesn't even know me, and I could just send him my Conan link. And it feels like it's more merit based. Like he gets that Conan link. Oh, this guy's funny. He's been on Conan. Come do my show. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's sometimes in the US it's different. It's like this agent has this big name. And if you want that big name, then you have to also book six of his other clients. And we're just talking about live booking shows now. There are only 52 weeks in a year. Yeah. So if a big time agent sort of says, well, if you want my guy to come, who's this A-list guy with a sitcom, you got to give me six or seven other weekends. You know what I mean? So now you're down to 45 weekends. So those weekends, they go away pretty fast. And it was like an honor for me to go to Asia and perform for expats. And what I didn't realize, talk about the legacy thing, is that there was a fledgling and a budding stand-up scene happening in all these different places. And I'm a big part of that. Not that I was doing the shows from a booker standpoint, but I got to go there, meet the other comics who were starting out comedy, hang out with them, influence them. And so, yeah, it's like, you know, I'm kind of like a part of the startup stand-up in these countries, you know, and I'm, so it's kind of cool. I didn't know I was doing that, but it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I've heard that. That's what Garen Chu said. He said you came there and you kind of gave a more legitimacy to their cause and to what they were doing, and people started to take it more seriously, and then it grew and started to boom. And now, like, there's a thriving Hong Kong comedy scene, and then it's also spilled into other parts of China, I guess, and stuff. Which is funny to me, like, that American stand-up would do well in China. It seems like the complete opposite of things.
Well, it's a combination of the expats being there, so they kind of get it. And so, and when you do comedy, and I've done comedy in even Europe, in like Norway, the Netherlands, but definitely in Asia as well, you have this sort of, your audience is always going to be comprised of, you can put them in two groups, right? English as the first language, English as the second or third language. And so your comedy has to play for those, for both of those groups. And then even English in a first language, it depending on how long they've been over there, they may not get all the references. So what I like about it is it's just form of comedy that is like, you can't lean on any of the, you can't, in a way you can't do some of the tricks. In a way you can, because there are a whole bunch of jokes that they've never heard. So, and some people take that bait, and they kind of just sort of like siphon off other comics and do old jokes that these people never heard. So that's not great, but that happens. But on the other end, you can't do like all the tricks, all the, when I say tricks, meaning too many local references. Not that that's a trick, but you can't do that. You can't, it's got to be just human life experience, because you're not sure if they've seen these TV shows you're going to reference, or they know these bands. So it's kind of like, in a way it's good, because for me, I've always, when I started, some of the people who were my mentors, they told me like, and I decided to not to be too topical, because why am I going to write a joke that I can't use again? And so that kind of takes politics off the table, because that's by nature topical, right? Don't be too dirty, because you want to be on TV. And even though some, you can be dirty and wildly successful for sure, but in terms of the stepping stones of like from comedy to late night shows to those kind of things, that's a clean journey. You know what I mean? So being clean, not being too topical, being universal, having jokes that work anywhere in the country, just all those things added to my being able to do comedy anywhere in the world.
Yeah, and
Where
that's the thing
they
is,
spoke English, yes.
yeah, I was gonna say, and that's the thing that people told me is like, even when I have, a good 15-minute set that I've used in LA and been building, but then as more of my friends started doing dry bar, like I think you've done it twice now, or twice or three
Yes,
times,
twice, yes.
twice, yeah, I'm trying to remember because I'm like go back and forth, so I'm like, is it this one? But it's
Right.
twice, and they have things that they don't want you to talk about. And one of my big jokes that always kills is about me being eaten by bears whenever I die. Well, that's a no-no for dry bar. It's not dirty, but it's not
Right.
part of their thing. So I had to go back to square one and start over. And I took actually from you, Tom Papa, and Jim Gaffigan, I went and wrote stories out about my life and then. And t did kind of like a Christopher Titus style of like talking about my family
Right,
and about things
right.
that happened and building it out like that. So it's a story, a big story thing that I could do about me being a girl dad and how that goes from me being a single dude who never had a sister, grew up with a single mom, to now being the dad of two daughters and a wife where I'm outnumbered in my house, three to
Right,
one
right,
and all
right. And
that stuff.
that's,
So.
yeah, that's great. And that's the thing. If you can build it up from your experience, people, no one can say you took it from them. And it won't, I think some of the cool kids have sort of taken comedy and redefined it for their own kind of selfish purposes. You know what I mean? And so when we say like something is hack, when you go to the Comedy Magic Club, where you're in that room, and even if you've been doing it 20 years, or over 20 years, there's a guy in the room that's been doing it 40 years, and all these guys in the room. And to see how younger comics sort of talk, or a younger comic is like, that's my joke. A guy who's been doing it 40 years is like, oh, I have a joke that's like that. And they talk about it. The one guy doesn't say, you can't do that joke anymore. It's just, if we were on the same show, we understand that, we may not do that joke, or if you do it first, I won't do it. It gets to be really like, the ego's out of it, and the sort of, I don't know, tribalism or the possessive nature of it is out of it. And the reason why I'm saying all this is because what we call hack, what the cool kids, younger than me and probably younger than you, it's they'll take entire subjects and say, that's hack. There's no subject that's hack. If you talk about it from your standpoint and from your point of view, it can never be hack. Because if something was, if there was such thing as like, this topic has been done, it's hack, then we wouldn't do comedy at all. Because anything we talk about, someone has talked about it, right?
Yep.
So it's more about how you talk about it. And I think, so the cool kids, sometimes if they hear you doing a joke, a difference between men and women, for instance, they shut off. Oh, that's hack.
Yeah.
It's like, no, if I'm talking about my experience, it can't be hack. You know what I mean? And so I'm glad that you retooled and did that, because otherwise you start talking about weird things just because it's different.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of weird too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And in LA, you feel like if you go to open mics, it's all the same material, Tinder jokes, dating jokes, whatever and stuff. And you're like, okay, right. Well, I'm not doing that. So I'm not going to talk about that. Obviously I'm married, I have kids. It's a whole different, I'm in a whole different world. So right. I have to talk about what my point of view is and what that is. And it's funny because I have daily things that come up, you know, like yesterday, my daughters were giving me a hard time. And I was like, after they left or whatever, I looked at my wife and said, how are we getting bullied by people we potty train? Like, this doesn't make any sense, right? And my wife was like, that's funny, right? So I wrote it down, you know? But it's just like, it really messed me up because I'm thinking about my life and my perspective of things. Who's going to come up with that? Who's going to think of that? You know, but parents will get it, right? Because they're going to go, oh, yeah, my kids do that too. And that's really what I want to tie it into.
Exactly. And that's the thing. Anything is fair game. You know, anything is fair game. But what I find is, as a comic, and I don't hate on anyone, but when I'm watching another comic, I can tell if this is their life and their journey, and they're just sort of sharing it, or if they reverse engineered it. They said, what will people like? You know, like people always think, like, Netflix is a thing where I used to write on this game show and do trivia. So there's a story about Netflix, and people believe it. And it goes, the creators of Netflix used to have a Blockbuster account. The guy who created it, he was late. He had a DVD or something, or a VHS tape that he returned late, got so mad about the late fees that he went and created Netflix. Now, that's a great story, right? But it's an urban myth.
Yeah,
the creators of Netflix, they said, oh, there's the internet. How can we make money? And they thought about it and they reverse engineered, which in business you should. You should reverse engineer, right? Define the problem and work backwards for the solution. But in comedy, when you do that, it's not as great. Like, meaning, like, you're a father of two, and that's your journey. Now, if I look at the crowd and I go, oh, okay, well, why does people have kids? How can I tap into that? And I work backwards. Now, I'm good enough at the craft to make that work, but it won't resonate as much. And sometimes you can tell when a comic does that. I don't get mad though. I don't hate on that situation, but hopefully it can be, you know, even if it's not about details about your life, it came from you. It's something you experienced or you thought, and you're not just trying to do what you think the audience likes.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And you heard my new joke that, and literally I wrote that joke like the day before I came, mm-hmm. came to do this. I kind of had an idea as I was going, driving around, and I was going to pick up my daughter from school, and we're going through the party planning thing for 16th, but all these things came up and I started to like just kind of flesh it out, and I was getting like mad in the car, like at the kids that wanted to be vegetarians diet or this thing, and then it just came out, and that's what I came up. Well, you guys gave me the best advice,
and that's the thing, and that's why with that joke, and for people listening, James has this joke about feeding, throwing a party and having to cater for someone who's vegan who's going to attend that party. And it's one of these things where, and as a comic, you do have to kind of know, even if you don't reverse engineer, you have to know what people are thinking. You have to know what they're thinking before they know, right? And so, yeah, it was like, you saying I don't like vegans, especially in LA, it's like, how's that going to play? You know what I mean? Right. And that's why I said, well, just tell them you're from Texas, which you are.
Yep.
That gives you the license to be like, I'm going to go hard at these vegans. And I'm not, and the thing is, you're not going at vegans because, oh, you know, I'm doing a show in Iowa. Let me crap on some vegans. this is really what happened, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and you gotta, and the cool kids also will tell you something is tone deaf, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to maneuver around that. And the fact that they tried to cancel Dave Chappelle tells you, like, it's like, wow, like, if he takes a topic, you know, he's going to really delve into it. And I think do it with from a position of love and respect, but extreme craft. It's nothing crass. He's not going to punch down. That's not what Dave does. But the fact that he took such care and people still tried to cancel him, it's just, this is where we're at, right? So just, yeah. So with that joke, I think a lot of people don't like vegans, but at the same time, a lot of people are moving toward veganism.
Yeah.
So you just have to take that into account when you write a joke like that. But start by saying you're from Texas, then you're like, I'm not just saying this. I got it honest. I'm from the proverbial meat capital of the world. Yeah. You know,
I'm from Central Texas, which is the barbecue capital of Texas. Like, legitimately, that's right. Where the best barbecue in America is from, is Central
right,
Texas.
Right,
so
right,
all I grew up around was meat. I didn't even know. I thought that vegetables were part of a meat thing. Like, you have steak and there's a potato. Like, that's, they were together. Like, they just grew next to each other. I didn't know.
See, that's funny. That's funny. You could be like, I didn't know you could eat a vegetable without meat. Like, I didn't even know that was.
No idea. Every potato I ever had bacon and other stuff. I'm like, okay, you got to have meat on everything.
But that's so funny. Like, if you go to a restaurant and they have like a side of veggies and you're like, I'm thinking about the veggies, but what meat comes with that?
Yeah. Can you tell me if there's pork or chicken or beef in there? I just need to know what's going on.
Right,
like, sir, it's just vegetables. That doesn't sound right to me, sir.
Right.
You guys don't know what you're doing in your kitchen.
Right. It's like, you could, like, where you're from, that's like just having gravy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't just sip gravy. Like, that's not going to happen, you know? Shots of gravy. Although, you know what? My wife would, because she loves... Her favorite two foods are mashed potatoes and gravy. That's not a joke. Yeah,
nice.
She would literally drink gravy, and it's, I'm like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, I'm a little weird like that. I'll drink olive juice after the olives are already gone. I know it's super salty. It's like a drinking brine, I guess, but I like it. Yeah.
This is a true story. I was so poor as a kid. I used to go to the Boys and Girls Club after school, and I couldn't afford Gatorade. So we'd be playing all day or whatever. I'd be tired. But they would sell pickle juice for 10 cents a cup.
Oh, wow.
So I would buy pickle juice and drink that instead because it does the same thing. It has electrolytes and salts.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I grew up drinking pickle juice thinking that was okay. And then my daughter, one daughter does cheerleading, one does dance. They came home one day and they were like, oh, we're so sore, whatever we need, whatever. And my wife was like, we don't have any Gatorade or anything. I was like, just drink pickle juice. And everybody was like, what? I was like, oh, no, it's the same. It's exactly the same thing. I found it out when I was a kid and whatever, you know, and we Googled it. It is a real thing. But like, yeah, they were like, something is wrong with you. I was like, yeah, I'm poor. That's what's wrong with me. Grew up poor. Now you've made movies. You've written on game shows. You've written a book, Hot Chocolate. Man, that book is awesome, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
I love that. And then you've done. How many specials have you done now? Is it four, three?
Well, yeah. I mean, let's count. If we count the little and the big ones, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, all of them.
So I have my first one was a Comedy Central half hour, a Comedy Central Presents. So if we count that, then I did Take Note.
I love Take Note.
Self-produced that. That was on Netflix. Now it's on Amazon. And then I did, I guess, two dry bar specials. So specials four. But I've also done, you know, Conan and late night shows. Like, I've done Conan. When I say Conan, I want to say seven times, but.
Wow.
But I think three times when he was in, three or four times when he was in New York, once when he was on The Tonight Show, and twice when he was on TBS. So whatever that.
Wow.
Maybe six or seven times. And, you know, I've done Colbert and before that, Craig Ferguson, you know, and that's the thing when I go overseas, like all these credits, you reach a point where it definitely helps on the road. It definitely helps. And I just did a show in Valencia, California the other day, and two different people were like, oh, I've been a fan of yours for years. You know, yeah. I think you get to that point nowadays, especially where, it's shifted to like your marketing is really what determines if you're going to be super big or not. short of getting a show, because if you get a show, that is the marketing for you. You're going into households every single week, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I've done almost everything in comedy you can do short of having my own show.
Right.
You know what I mean?
We got to get you one of those, man. That has to happen. Like, that would be
great.
That'd be awesome. Because you're amazing. Then, like, I would love you to be in my house every week. I would watch the heck out of the Dwayne Perkins show.
Thank you. I got to make it happen. But also, like, before we started recording, I was sharing with you that audition I had.
Yeah.
Which is, and I'm like, oh, I don't even want to talk about it. But if they're all going to be like that, I don't know.
You know what? I will write a movie for you to be the star of, because you're like one of my favorite people, and I can see just killing it in a movie. Look, there's so many comedians that are underrated that you're like, why does nobody know about them? You know, I feel that's the way with you. It's like, you're there, but like, why is nobody talking about that?
And you know, it becomes a thing where you can't lose sleep over that, because it's a timing issue, you know, because I'm a big sports guy. And so when I think of, you know, Charles Barkley doesn't have a ring. Karl Malone, John Stockton. These are great players who, it just didn't happen that they were on the best team any given year, even though they were great players. And I think in comedy, once you, like, people who know comedians, you know, it's, the issue too is that a lot of people don't know comics, and a lot of people don't, many people have never been to a comedy show. So now we went from people kind of not knowing this mysterious thing to knowing it just through social media and Instagram. So they still don't know what it is. You know, they either think it's like, they think it's people doing really short YouTube videos, or they think it's people being cool on stage. It's whatever you think, it's really determined by the algorithm and how, what kind of videos you're watching, you know? But I think it's sort of like, people in my life, what I'm getting at is like, people who don't know comedy, or they only know me a little bit, they either think I'm rich or they think I'm starving, poor. Like, because you see like a guy on TV, you go, oh, that guy must be rich. And then you see a guy not on TV, you're like, oh, he must be struggling. And that is, I could see why people would think that. But the reality is though, I know comics personally who've never been on TV, who pulled down six figures a year, who put two or three kids through college, you know what I mean? Through just a bunch of shows, corporates, cruise ships. So I think you find your place. And as long as, you know, you're still making a good or a really good living to do what you love, you know, you really, there's no complaints, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. Mine turned during the pandemic from stand up to writing a lot of content for people and for things.
Right.
So that's, mine went to more comedy writing. So I kind of got away from it, but I was like, all right, I'm a stand up. Like when somebody asks me what I do, I'm a stand up. And then my wife's like, oh, and a comedy writer. I'm like, yeah, and a comedy writer, but I'm a stand up first. Right. Like I want to do that. So, but my funnel of money has gone from to writing, where I'm not making, you know, as much doing stand up, but I'm making a lot more writing content for people.
You know, and that's the thing. It's weird. I think that maybe because I am a comic, but I hold us comics in the highest regard. I think people don't realize to the extent how much we are writers and we're directors.
Yeah.
In a sense that we're telling these stories on stage. They have to have a beginning, middle, and end. We get to immediate feedback. We're looking at the crowd. So we know generally what they get, what they don't get, you know? And I think every movie, like every movie before it's like final cut and it's edited, they should let a few comics watch it, because we will always tell you where there's some sort of inconsistency or something that doesn't make sense, you know? Yep. And as you do comedy, you have to realize you are becoming a writer. And my journey was like yours, where, you know, because of my jokes, people would always be like, "Are you a writer?" And I'm like, "Oh, I guess I'll write my jokes." And I didn't fully embrace it. And then I realized that Mark Twain, who is known to be a writer, was actually one of the first comics, in a sense. He did spoken
for the first four, one of the first four.
Yeah. And so when I was like, wait, if Mark Twain, it was a comic, then I guess I'm a writer. And so then I embraced it. And I'm so glad that you're coming to that. And I think you're coming to it even quicker than I did, because we are writers. And some people will say to us, oh, you guys know how to write jokes, but you don't know how to tell stories. And that's not true. We know story and joke.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's the thing is the first time when you did my show, we were talking outside the show and you said, what do you do besides stand up? And I said, oh, I do a podcast. And you said, and then you said, what else? And I said, oh, nothing right now. He's like, and you're like, you need to do other things. Like you need to learn to write. You need to learn to write scripts. You need to learn to write sketches. You need to learn to write, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh dang, I didn't think about that. And like, when you hit me with that, it totally changed my mindset where I was like, I can't just be the guy who gets up and stands on a mic and says that because that's 5 minutes out of 24 hours. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
yes.
Right.
It takes time to write jokes, but the rest of the day, like Jerry Seinfeld's 23 hours a kill. That's, you know, 23 hours and 55 minutes or whatever stage time you're not doing to that. You have to fill with something else.
Right. Right.
Why not learn all the other things? And then, made the movie for Hulu and that like blew me away too. I was like, oh my gosh, he's telling me, he's giving me the blueprint and the advice right here and saying, James, don't be an idiot. Step up and figure these things out.
Right.
And then you were doing it. I was like, I have to listen. I don't know.
That's so crazy. I don't even remember telling you that, but I'm so glad that I did.
I say it all the time to people that you told me these things.
And I believe I did. You know why too? Because in LA, you don't have the luxury of just doing stand-up. Like New York comics, they have the luxury, or they think they have the luxury of just doing stand-up because New York City, I mean, at any given moment, there's going to be 6 to 7 stand-up clubs, maybe more. We're talking in a short, all within 10 miles of each other, basically a short train ride or cab fare. And then in addition, there are going to be another 20 rooms that are always going, just different places that do comedy. So you got 7 to 8 comedy clubs, 20 other rooms. And then if you include Long Island, New Jersey, upstate New York. And so a guy can do easily, once you get in, you're looking at doing 10 sets a week, right?
Yeah.
And just really razor sharp. But in LA, even if you hustle, you may be able to do 4 spots a week.
Yep.
So the hustle in LA is different. Like in New York, in LA, every comic, at some point you should have your sitcom ready, you're this ready, you're that ready. And in New York, I'm just going to be this razor sharp, prolific comic who does Conan every twice a year or whatever the case, or does late night twice a year. And that's a different path. But yeah, in LA, you got to get your hustle on. And the quicker you can get it on, the better. Because who knew that a pandemic was going to happen? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So,
it's crazy. And so if you were diversified to begin with, and you could weather that storm a little bit more.
Yeah, I would actually, right after that, I started writing my first screenplay. And it was terrible, by the way. It was like the worst thing ever. It was Encino Man meets Frankenstein was the idea behind it anyways.
Right,
so like
right,
this
right.
family takes in like this zombie-esque Frankenstein.
That's
kind of
cool.
Kid.
Yeah, yeah.
But it fell apart. I don't know what, I still have no idea how to fix it. It sits on my hard drive. I go to it from time to time to be like, what can I do? But I never can figure it out. But I've come up with a million other ideas. And it also opened doors for me to punch up some people's sitcoms and work with some bigger comedians and work on a ton of other stuff. But all because when I was sitting across from you and you said that to me, my brain was like, oh, dang. Like, why have I never thought of that before? But you unlock this whole other world of me. And then, yeah, you have a book. You have albums. You had a movie on Hulu that you made. You wrote right on a – do you still write on the game show or is that game show over?
Well, we've been on hiatus for 2 years. So that's a long hiatus. With these things, you never know. But it's still not done. So we may come back. I'm not sure yet, though.
That's awesome. And then what do you do other writing stuff? Have you written your own sitcom? I would love to see a Dwayne sitcom. That'd be awesome.
I have. I've written several, actually. Some with me as the vehicle, some without me as the vehicle. Yeah, I've written several. And I've written spec scripts. You know, like the first thing I ever wrote. And I think my issue is, and you know, talking about giving you advice, I need to shift from the writing to the selling or getting it read, you know.
Yep.
Now
that's
God is good
too.
Yeah, God is good, and typically, you know, like I think it's with God or universe, however you want to think of it. You take one step toward Him, He takes two toward you. That's what they say, right?
Yep.
And so, I've written so much stuff, and I haven't been as diligent about making sure it gets read by enough people. And so my new thing now, which I'll share with you, is I'm just thinking out loud, but I think everything I've ever written, I got to get to 100 no's, you know?
Yeah.
So if I write it and I think it's good, I need 100 people. And it gets tough too when you have like a manager, because you don't know who they're showing it to, and you kind of let them take the lead. And then they come back and say, oh, people weren't interested. And you're like, okay, was one person not interested? With 30 people, you know, you never know that. So that gets to be tough. And then sometimes you need to go through these gatekeepers. But short of that, anything I write now, I need 100 people or entities or whatever to tell me no. Right. Then I can feel like, not only did I write it, but I put it out there, because I have so many things I never put out there. Even my spec scripts, like I wrote a King of Queens back in the day, and who knows? But here's the thing about that one. This guy named Rock, who I'm spazzing on his last name right now, but he literally wrote on King of Queens. He was a comic, and he read it and gave me notes, which was so cool. And the thing is, the notes he gave me, he wasn't like, this is awful. So that was, it was encouraging, you know? Right. Then I wrote a Scrubs. I wrote a Scrubs spec. I think it's really good. And I don't think I had enough people read that. I think I had like this one manager read it and they never got back to me or whatever, maybe two. Then I wrote a Flight of the Conchords, which I thought was really funny. And I wrote the songs and the whole thing. And then I heard the industry was like, well, we're pivoting away from spec scripts as samples. So then, I mean, even before that, I had written my own first thing I wrote was a sitcom, actually, with my old manager. Then these spec scripts, then I started writing other sitcoms, and then I wrote with other people. I've written movies. And here's the thing, you get better with each one you write, but short of that, you get solid in, like, I don't believe in having entitlement, but you feel worthy. You feel like, because you write one, you're like, okay, but you write 10, it doesn't even matter at that point how good they are. You've written 10 things. So you have to feel like I belong. Right. You know what I mean? And so that's where I'm at. And when I watch things now, I still don't try to, I never want to be a hater, but I watch things and I'm like, I know I could do that. And I'm not just saying it. I've literally done it, so I know I could do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's funny because I was complaining to my wife yesterday. I watched a movie on Amazon that's an Amazon original or whatever. It's called Jolt, if anybody cares.
I haven't seen it yet. Yeah.
Yeah, and I watched it, and I was like, this got made? There's so many plot holes in this entire story. Who approved it? Like, what happened here?
Right.
And it's like, did you just want Kate Beckinsale to beat up people for an hour and a half?
Right.
Is that all you wanted? Because that's what it is. It's a woman with an anger disorder. It's called explosive something disorder. I don't know. IED was what, explosive emotional disorder or something like that. And she had to shock herself to calm herself down, which was the opposite of Jason Statham in that movie where he had to shock himself to like stay alive.
Right.
So it was like that. And then it was like John Wick. She was like beating up all these people and killing all these people because her guy she went on 3 dates with supposedly died, and now she wants revenge. It's like, you just knew him. If I went on a date with a girl for 3 times,
right,
you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And,
well,
and she disappears. I'm not going to go on a hunting spree now.
And you know, the crazy thing about that is, as you write, and you'll probably find it in this true, even before you were writing, just as a comic, because we're always observing and seeing the holes in things. Then you start writing and you really see the holes in things. And when you go to the movies with people who don't write, you have to kind of like, you don't want to spoil the movie for them. You know what I mean? And but it takes, you have to be like, this makes no sense. This makes no sense. And you can tell as a writer now, you can watch something and go, they wrote this whole movie, then they realized they had that hole and they tried to plug it, as opposed to like rewriting and making it make sense. And you're watching things, you can tell when something is plugged, when the foreshadowing happens the scene before. Like foreshadowing is supposed to happen way before, but when they set something up, like the literally that scene before, you're like, oh, they realized they had this issue and they just tried to plug it in. And I've written with people where we do that. And I'm like, this is not going in the right way because we're plugging in the holes. And had we sort of designed it right, just like building a real house, have we designed it right from the bottom up, we wouldn't have these holes to begin with, you know? And that's, so yeah, it's like the thing about doing something, I don't care what it is. If you make cakes or if you play music, if you do it enough, that at the very least you feel like, okay, I have some level of competency and I should feel okay showing it to people or walking into certain rooms. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I still have that fear. That's my problem is I have freelance written, I've ghost written, I've done all this stuff. I've written my own things, but I still feel unworthy to like approach anyone like, oh, right. People are like, you should be looking for a manager and agent. And I'm like, I don't feel worthy of that yet. Like, I don't feel
right,
like I'm,
right.
I'm worth their time. And so it holds me back from moving forward on any of those projects. Right. And I have a bunch sitting on my hard drive.
And right. So, but that's the thing, as much as it holds you back, and it really does, it also helps to the point where when you do build up that courage or whatever to show people, if you look at everything you've written, I think this is the best two things I'm going to show this to people. You know, at that point you can feel like you're at least not wasting their time, you know?
Yeah.
Because like you said, you watch movies, like, how did this movie get made? I watch things. And one thing I'm good at, I can watch a movie and I can tell if it's written and directed by the same person.
Right. Yep.
Right. Typically because they fall in love with it and it'll just be too long. They don't make the edits. Right.
Yeah.
And you're like, and this guy, and so sometimes you're watching a movie and you're like, oh, this has holes. It's too long. It's a lot of different things. You get to the end. It's written and directed by the same person. Sometimes that person has a lot of juice, has a lot of clout, and you go, okay, no one could tell this person. So it is what it is. They have a lot of success in Hollywood. They get to call the shots now. That's fine. But other times you look and you go, this is a first time director. So that is a first time director. And we're not talking about like a movie that you could tell they self-financed or
right.
I'm talking about a major big time money, first time director. And he gets to direct and write it and seemingly have no, doesn't have to answer to anyone. And you're like, how does this happen? And it's really weird. And I think sometimes movies benefit from having one person and one vision, but sometimes it hurts a movie too. Sometimes it's better if the writer is a different person than the director and the producer is a different person. Because the producer is always going to be like, I need to make it short as possible, save money. The writer is going to be like, I need to convey this. And the director is like, I need to show this. So if you can have three people and they work together, that's always going to be better than one person with no input from anyone else, typically. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, and that would explain. I mean, I love Quentin Tarantino movies, but they're a lot of them go way longer than they needed to.
Right.
But he does a great job. It's, you're not going to tell Quentin no, but then like right. If I tried to make that movie, all my movies, every time I write a screenplay, I go 90 minutes. That is all I want, is 90 minutes. I want it to be as fun and fast-paced as possible. So by the time you're done with it, you left and went, "Man, I could have watched that for another hour, but it was amazing for what I got." That's what I want.
And that comes from stand-up, right? Because you always want to leave them wanting more. Yeah. And it's a lesson I have to learn. And it's tough because sometimes I'm working on new jokes and I need to do a certain amount of time. But if I show up at a place and they're like, do 45. And sometimes like I'm having fun, I lose track of time and I'm at 50 minutes. And you could just like, say I got a huge laugh at minute 43. And I could have been like, thank you, good night, right?
Yeah.
And no one would have cared. That's close enough to 45 minutes. But then I'm like, then I do more jokes. And then like, now they're getting tired. And now I'm like, I need another big laugh to get off. Cause you want to leave on a high note. And now you're at 50 minutes. And now it's 50 minutes and you're like on stage. And you're like, oh, it's really hot in here.
Yeah.
I'm tired. I know they're tired. And so as a comic, you go through that night in and night out, knowing that, just have the discipline to be like, when the first big laugh I get after 40 minutes or 42 minutes, I'm getting off. And that translates to when you write things too. And the rules of writing are every scene, you get in late, you get out early.
Yep.
So if two people are planning a bank robbery, we can start with them sitting in a booth at a diner talking about the bank robbery. We don't start with them outside. Hey, good to meet you. I'm Bob. I'm Jim. You know, like you start with them. And then as soon as they agree to do it, whatever the bank robbery, next scene.
Yeah.
And it, and so you're watching things and you're like, oh, and you don't want to hate. Like, I always joke about the Joker movie, which was a good movie, but
yeah,
I always thought like his back should have been nominated.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Because it was just like, and you know what else is that? It's because he's such a great actor, Joaquin Phoenix, as a director and as a writer. When you have a great actor, that's a detriment. Because yeah, now you can make the scene long because that actor's so captivating. But I think everything should be written as if you have a bad actor.
Yeah.
Like, assume the actor is going to be god awful and you need them to talk as little as possible just to convey what's happening. And that's a better movie. And then boom, you also put a really good actor in that role. But yeah, great, good actors, really, these great actors, sometimes they bail out bad writing and bad editing, you know?
Yeah, and that's just the truth. And yeah, so what do you have going on? Where can people find you? Where can people see some of your stuff and get
caught? Well, you know, talk about specials. I'm kind of trying to put together another special now. And I don't know. It doesn't have a home yet or anything. And, you know, like if the Dry Bar people approach me, I may just do it that way. But I kind of want to do a, I have an idea for two specials, actually. It's really weird. One is a short one and one is a longer one. So I'm working on that, or at least from gathering the material, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And in terms of where can people find me, they can still buy my book, Hot Chocolate for the Mind, on Amazon.
I recommend it.
Yes. My book, Zombie Run, I don't think it's on Amazon anymore, but me and Koji, who I wrote it with, Koji Sakai, we are going to probably take Zombie Run and do a podcast with it. And it may be an audible book, or it may be some sort of a mystery podcast. It's a love story, a post-apocalyptic love story with two human beings fall in love, even though they live in a zombie world. I'm really proud of that. And so, yeah. And then other than that, I have Dwayne Explains, is a little video thing I do on my Instagram. People can see that, little 2-minute clips, and I'm performing all over. So people can find me on DwayneParkins.com. I'm picking up shows now that we're opening up.
Do you not do Off the Top anymore? I know you used to do. I love that. I used to.
No, I haven't actually. Yeah, thank you. And that's how I know Today's a Good Day was one of your favorite songs. Or your favorite song. We may bring back Off the Top, but no. But I do have another podcast now called The Unofficial Official Story.
Okay.
And basically, we pick different sort of urban conspiracy theories and urban myths, and we explore them and we make a new theory. Like a new, we have our new explanation. That's why it's called The Unofficial Official Story. Also, in my movie night podcast, we don't do it anymore, but we have archived over 200 episodes where we talk about movies, just like we did today. So if people like that, they can find my movie night podcast. It's still online.
If you ever want to make movie podcasts, I'd be happy to be your co-host, man.
Anytime. Oh, that'd be great.
I'll do anything because you're like one of my favorite people. You're so personable and fun and just
thank you.
I don't know. Probably one of the best people I've ever met since I've been in LA. I mean, I have a lot of good comedy friends.
Thank you, man.
Like, when you were talking to me, like, we've known each other for 10 years and you're giving me this advice, and I feel like this is like my big brother giving me advice and telling me how to do better in the world.
I appreciate you, man. And yeah, you're one of the good guys that I've met as well. And I'm glad that you're still doing it, because sometimes in LA you see someone and you might see them like once a week for like a year, and then you don't see them for another year.
Yep.
And it doesn't mean that they stopped or you stopped. That's just how the rhythm of LA works. So when it was so good that you reached out to me, and so good to see you on that show that we did last week. So
And you guys have to check out that show, Hands Up Comedy. It was amazing. It was just like, the feedback was amazing. The people watching were amazing. The production was amazing. Andre was just awesome. I was like, they're doing something awesome here. And I know that everybody's, you know, it's still kind of COVID-y world. And when you can do that live, if you can do that show live at some point, that show, I know that people are like, oh, it's like Kill Tony. It's better than Kill Tony. It's nicer. It gives you actionable feedback. The people there are encouraging. I think, honestly, if you could bring that show live somewhere, blow up.
That's a great idea. We should, because basically it's a show where we watch comics. And it's a range. Some guys who are pros like yourself, some guys just starting. and we give them notes. And what's beautiful about it is that we give them general notes, but then we give them funny, funny tags. And so it's like you're in, it's like you're watching a comedy show. And then in between a comedy show, you're in a writer's room. And it's kind of a cool, it's really a cool thing. So the hand up, that's an, I'm glad you plugged that too, because that's a really great show that we do monthly. Yeah.
It is fantastic. And you guys have to go check it out. I was blown away by how just every, I don't know how long you guys have been doing it, but it's like, it was like the most professional Zoom show I've ever been on. It was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Not quite a year yet. So that's probably our, maybe 8 months. Maybe that was our eighth show, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. If you bring it to like LA or you have it where you can do it live somewhere, I think it'll kill. And if you could do it like even weekly, we have like a weekly version of that, kind of like what Kill Tony did, you would just blow up and then audio and video record it and do the same thing that Kill Tony did. But this is a positive version. It's a way of like making people feel what comedy is supposed to be.
Which is so interesting, because in this cancel culture, with people getting canceled for saying or doing certain things, and we're constantly sort of like fighting for the little guy in a sense. But then you got Kill Tony, you got Battle Rules. So it's this weird duality of like, we're kind of fighting for the little guy, but we're getting meaner at the same time. It's a weird thing. Maybe we're getting meaner because people are, maybe that's a, sort of the pendulum swinging back because of all the political correctness. I'm not sure, but I like the show we do only because I don't need to bring a young comic on and crap all over them for.
Yeah.
Like, what do I get out of that? Even if it's funny, it just doesn't, I don't gain anything from it, you know?
Well, and I've seen this personally. I know people who have gone on Kill Tony, got the feedback, and then literally quit comedy after that. They were like, that was too much. It was just not, they don't like what I said. I was like, dude, it was one, first of all, it's 1 minute of your material. Secondly, who cares? They were, that's their job, is to roast you, whatever, move on. And you know, if you feel like that joke sucks now because of it, fine, throw that joke away, write a new joke. That's what we do.
Right.
I've had plenty of times where I've died from a joke where I've like done the joke and the whole room's just like nothing. And I'm like, okay, well apparently that's not the joke. That's I thought it was funny. They didn't think it was funny. Okay. I'm okay.
Exactly.
With that.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's the audience should tell you again, like I said earlier, who you are or what's funny, what's not funny. Not some other comic who may have an ulterior motive, you know?
That's the other thing. That's what I feel like is like, yes, their whole goal of that show is to roast people and whatever, and to make it as funny as possible while being kind of mean about it, which happens. But it's like, okay, that's the point of the show. Don't take it up there thinking that's the end all be all. They're not they're not opening the door or closing the door for you to be a stand up anymore. They're just giving you feedback, you know, however it is. And some of my favorite people, the Verzi triplets, went on there and they were like, you need to change your whole stick. And I was like, no, that's what people love about you, is you guys are these three silly, goofy brothers, and you don't need to be dirty and dark and whatever and weird to get more laughs. People love you the way you are. And they kind of have balanced back and forth that they're not sure still.
And it's so crazy because, you know, just in terms of like my political leanings, you know, I'm liberal. I'm very accepting, you know. Yeah. I think I come across as conservative just as in terms of how I live my own life. I may be not fiscally conservative, but more like like lifestyle conservative.
Nobody's fiscally conservative.
right. But it's just this weird thing where, like what I was going to say is the people who seem to be winning, if there's such a term, winning in Hollywood now, a lot of times they're winning. It's like these alt rooms, you know, really funny guys, but they're doing like rooms with 60 people. That's fine. But then they get a TV show off that. You know what I mean? And when you go to like the Midwest and other parts of this country, you know, and you go to a comedy club with 200 people, they don't always want the same thing that, you know, 30 people in the back of a comic book store want, you know? Yeah. And so, yeah, like if these guys are doing this crazy, goofy thing, and it's like, it's almost like who, what's cool? And who's the sort of gatekeeper for cool? And it usually has nothing to do with what really real people like, you know?
Yep. So, yeah, I mean, I learned that growing up, right? When I was a kid, I liked comic books. I liked all this nerdy stuff. People would beat me up and say, you're nerd, you're never going to be cool, whatever. Now it's like the coolest thing in the world. Marvel movies are the biggest movies ever. It's like,
exactly.
Apparently I was ahead of my time. I'm okay with that. Well, Dwayne, I want to say thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Again, DwaynePerkins.com. Go look him up. Dwayne Perkins everywhere that you want to find him. Yes. Gives great advice. Pick up his book. Seriously, there's some great stories in there. That should be a movie or a sitcom or like a Christopher Titus style one-man show of your journey in life, because that book is just amazing. There's so many ups and downs and wild stories, and you're like,
thank you, man. I appreciate that, and I actually been meaning to do that. Like, not that, but I want to do a thing where either myself or a different friend, I have them read one of the essays. I want to do a thing where each week I read an essay. So yeah. I'm still figuring out how, but yeah, I appreciate it.
If you need someone to read it, I volunteer myself 100%, man.
I may take you up on that, because yeah, it's just a thing where maybe if I have people read their favorite one, that way it's a way of sharing the story with their fan base. And also I get to hear it out loud. So something like that. Yeah.
And then you can kind of recall some other events that maybe you didn't write in there. Like, yeah, I didn't write this down, but there was this thing and this thing happened. And whatever. Because I know there's got to be more to some of the stories. I'm like, I'm reading them. I'm like, this is 3 pages. There's more here. There's something else that he's missing that he didn't think of when he wrote this out.
Exactly. You know? It's exactly so. Right. Yeah. Well, thank you. You've given me a really good idea. We'll talk about that more. So, yes.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Dwayne. Thank you, everybody. Please like, subscribe. Please go check out Dwayne. Please go watch all his specials. You won't. He's not a teacher, right? No matter what the blue shirt with the gray sweater vest, all that stuff says, no matter what that says, like he's not a teacher. You think so? You think that he's ready to teach you some amazing class, like it's a master class. I mean, it's a master class of comedy, but it's not a regular class. So.
Right. I appreciate awesome. That.
No problem. Thank you, everybody. Have a good one and bye.